Case of the Frozen Pussy, Slip or Trip, The Million Dollar Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will find on the Miami Memoirs podcast. Strange Cases and Wild Tales presents real case histories and true stories related to the law practice and experiences of a creative Florida attorney reaching out over 60 years. There's more than meets the eye. In these sparkling memoirs, Florida attorney Louis Ress uncorks a caseload of true, weird, wonderful, and wild stories from an always eventful 6 decades of life in the law. Before we begin, I would like to tell you about a new book from Louis. Miami Memoirs, including The Maharani's Ring, Round 2 from the Amazing Life and Times of Legendary South Florida Attorney Louis Ress, takes readers from Brooklyn in the 1940s, via a spell in a top-secret Army department, and a transatlantic solo flight in a replica Spirit of St. Louis, to adventures in and out of the courtroom in a sometimes rougher-than-ready 50s and 60s Miami. The book is available on Amazon, just search Louis Ress. And now let's begin.
Hi everyone, welcome to Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales with Louis Ress. I'm Jeanette, your host, and today we're on episode 36, The Bridge Group. Okay, Louis, tell us about The Bridge Group. Is that a card game or group?
Yep, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
The Bridge Group is concerns a card game.
Ah, all right, let's hear it.
Well, my good friend and client, Bill Connors, who was the claims manager for the Aetna Casualty Insurance Company here in Miami, he had a small bridge group that met every Thursday night. And they alternated at different homes, and they always had beer and scotch. The game was not high stakes, but it came about when Bill ran into one of his neighbors at the Purple Onion. The Purple Onion was a local cocktail lounge in a shopping center. And one thing led to another. And after 3 martinis, they were talking about 2 of the other neighbors. These people all lived in the Pinecrest neighborhood of South Miami, which is now a very elegant neighborhood. Mm-hmm. At that time, they had relatively small homes, but they were located on these huge lots. And they all were bridge enthusiasts, cards enthusiasts. And so the Thursday night bridge game came about.
And were they old friends of yours?
Well, no. They were just, they were not old friends of Bill's. They were, I didn't know them, I hardly knew them.
Okay.
They were Bill Connors' friends, and they were neighbors, just neighbors. They knew very little about one another, and the conversation was pretty general. It started out with comments about how their homes were going up in value, with the new buyers knocking down the old homes and constructing massive structures for millions of dollars.
Wow.
Then the talking shifted to occupations. And it turns out that Bill Connors, as I told you, was a claims manager for the Aetna Casualty. And John Simmons was a car dealer. And Paul Ostwald was an FBI agent, as was his wife. She was a lady FBI agent. In those days, that was very unusual.
Yeah.
And Tom Reedy, who was the guy that the story really is about, ran a consulting company. The name Tom Reedy was not unknown to the Oswalds. The Oswalds were with the FBI. And Paul Oswald, the FBI agent, said nothing, but he knew that Tom Reedy was mob-connected.
Oh, okay.
Deeply, deeply mob-connected, out of New Jersey. It was generally known that Miami was an open territory. And by the way, the story is about the mafia.
Oh,
that's
okay.
What we're getting into. It sounds not the bridge game.
Ah, I love it.
Miami was an open territory. There was no particular family involved in Miami. And it was a situation where everyone would leave the other guy alone. And it was mostly controlled by the Miami Beach Syndicate.
And so was there a Miami Mafia?
Yes and no, actually. There is a Miami organization, but it was not like New York or Chicago. It was not like Genovese or Bonanno or something like that.
Yeah.
Or Luciano. It was, or Trafficante. Trafficante is over in, I would say, the west coast of Florida, Tampa. And they're still probably the most powerful mafia family in Florida. But Miami was an open area. And there was Meyer Lansky ran it. And before him, Al Capone was down, but Al Capone was with the Chicago mob. So there were no rival mob battles here. They weren't shooting and killing one another over territory or businesses. Mm-hmm. Miami was not clean, but it was not a mob battle. I don't know if you remember Senator Estes Kefauver. He was chairman of the Senate Crime Investigation Committee. Huh. He wore a coonskin cap. I think he came from Tennessee or Kentucky or something. He was really an interesting fellow. And he conducted these hearings wearing a coonskin cap.
And what a sight.
He came down to Miami and they did a crime investigation. So they brought the sheriff of Dade County, was known as Dade County then. Mm-hmm. They brought him on to testify. And they asked him how come he had accumulated $1 million in the bank when he only had a salary of $5,000 a year. And his answer was, I'm thrifty.
So what happened to the sheriff?
Nothing.
Oh, really?
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
Nothing. The investigation came and went, and that was it. There was tremendous gambling money, mostly gambling. Is with him when he came. There was a numbers racket, uh-huh. and there was a lot of prostitution. Mm. That was mostly where the money was coming from. There were no drugs, no drug dealings in those days. The bridge game went on for years, and Tom Reedy participated along with the Oswalds. And finally, Tom Reedy left for New Jersey, and he was called upon. He was connected with the New Jersey mob, the mafia, mm-hmm. and he was called upon to close out a major national grocery chain. The company was going bankrupt, and it appeared that some of Tom's associates had decided to invest in the food stores, and they wanted Tom to see what he could do to salvage or save anything for a profit, mm-hmm. and to keep his eye on the dissolution. So Tom Reedy goes up to New Jersey as an outside consultant and for this company. It's called B&G, and I made that up. You can figure out who it was. He's going to keep his eye on this dissolution. And after he attended a few meetings up in New Jersey, he was brought in as a vice president to assist in the bankruptcy administration of the company, because they know who he was. And they gave him a substantial salary with fringe benefits. Well, the B&G grocery chain stretched across the entire country with over 200 stores. It was big.
Mm-hmm. So what was causing the problem?
Well, B&G groceries were losing a fortune because of labor disputes and strikes, high employee salaries, large employee fringe benefits, union-called sympathy strikes, including the transportation union, internal theft, employee absenteeism, break-ins, and their trucks were being hijacked regularly.
Oh, wow.
The B&G logo involved intertwining their letters, the B and the G, with colors of red and black. They sure were very deeply in the red, and things were getting worse and were looking pretty black.
So what could Tom Reedy do to help the situation?
Well, as I told you, Tom Reedy was organized crime.
Yeah.
So he was asked to meet with the union and to report back to the board of directors. Well, the meeting with the union never occurred because a phone call was made from one of Tom's associates informing the union of Tom's connections. And the union recommended that Tom be made president of the company so that he could deal directly with the unions with full authority.
Oh, okay.
So suddenly, Tom Reedy was president of B&G. Well, what happened? The strike stopped, first of all. No one would strike against the mafia.
Yeah.
New salaries for all the employees were scaled down, and they didn't complain when they were told they were getting the big salary increases were being cut down. There was no more slowdowns at work. You know, people would slow down. The unions would slow down the work.
Yeah.
That was over with. There were absolutely no employee thievery. You know, internal thievery goes on tremendously. A lot of companies go bankrupt just from the internal theft.
Wow.
That stopped. Not one single truck of the company was touched. and all deliveries were made promptly and courteously. There was no more hijacking of the trucks. You can imagine why. You hijack a mafia truck, you got a problem.
Yeah.
In fact, it was the mafia who was doing the hijacking.
Yeah, yeah.
So Tom told the company that there would be no further need for internal security and no need for a night watchman at these stores. Every employee showed up on time every day and worked diligently without complaint. The company went into the black. Wall Street noted the marvelous turnaround of B&G, and the stock rose. Tom and his associates had plenty of that stock. So Tom retired as CEO after 5 years.
Wow.
And then the company went bankrupt.
Yeah, that's quite a story. A story within a story.
Right. And it was during this first five-year period that Bill Connors, my friend who was organized the bridge game,
uh-huh.
told me that he had recommended me to represent Tom Reedy.
Oh, okay.
The mafia guy. So shortly before he left for New Jersey, I had been introduced to Tom Reedy, and Bill Connors and I had dinner with him. Tom Reedy was very casually dressed. He wore socks with laced shoes, tan leather shoes. He was surprisingly quiet and soft-spoken, and he had a very nice smile and seemed like a middle-level executive type. There was no way of knowing.
Yeah, he seems nothing like a mafia type.
No, he wasn't. He was not at all flamboyant, and he was not tough, and he spoke very, very clearly and distinctly, and he was literate, and he was pleasant. I was really surprised. One morning he called me. From New Jersey. He was calling from New Jersey. He said, "Lewis, I need you to help me." I said, "What is it?" He said, "I need you to find my daughter. She's missing."
Oh, no.
Well, what was he calling me for? I'm thinking, if he can't find his daughter, how am I supposed to? He's, you know, got the mafia there connected all over.
Yeah.
I figured that there must be some reason he would not want to call the police. Well, obviously, he wouldn't want to call the police and get them involved in his life.
Yes.
But he didn't know. So I said, "Tell me a little bit about it, please. Tell me some more about it." He said, "She just disappeared. She was living in Miami, and I haven't been able to find her now for 5 days.
Oh, wow.
I said, "What was she on, and where was she last seen?" I figured that out first.
Yeah.
He said, "She was in South Miami and on horse." You know what? You know what that is?
No.
Horse?
Is it a drug?
I forget that. It's a very, very strong drug, like cocaine.
Okay.
And not like marijuana.
Mm-hmm. So it's like an upper.
You inject it.
Yeah, it's an upper. It's just
I forget. Anyhow, she was on horse.
Okay.
So I said, let me see what I can do. And I had his address and his special phone number. And I also had, at that time, two DEA agents working for me as investigators.
Oh, okay.
And all they wanted to know was what she was on and where and when she was last seen. Well, they knew every dealer in South Florida, and they let it be known whose daughter she was. And they knew that she would be seeking, it was heroin, that's it.
Oh,
she would be seeking heroin, and they knew who was dealing it. So they picked her up in Homestead. And within 24 hours, we had her on a plane back to Newark, where her father met her at the airport. And the next day, I get a call. It's Tom Reedy. He said, "Lewis, thanks for everything. Send me a bill. And more importantly, if I can do you any kind of a favor, anything, just pick up the phone."
Was that the end of it?
No, my bill. What do you bill a mafia boss?
Yeah.
It's always a problem with the bill.
Yeah.
Well, this wasn't legal work. I don't know if you remember, I represented the second richest man in the world, and I had to send him a bill for something. And he said, "I'm not paying you for that. That's not legal work."
Huh.
So if you bill nothing, the mafia are very offended. They don't want you to be, they don't want to be obligated to
you.
And they want to pay for what they get. They don't want anything or nothing. But if you bill too much, it's worse. They can get incensed. So I sent a very modest bill, and I got paid by his wife. She sent me a check. And they never heard back. If I ever need a favor, he said, anything, just pick up the phone. You better be nice to me.
And did you ever call in that favor?
No, I haven't heard from Tom Reedy, and he's probably passed on. And Bill Connors died. He was a great guy, Bill Connors. So no, I've never heard from
you. Never did, huh?
No.
So what does the Bridge Group story say to us?
Well, it's really not the Bridge Group. It's really a story about the mafia and about how they took over this company and turned it around. So we talk about running a business. Running a big business is not easy. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them fail because it's complex and it's difficult to deal, like with the government alone. Just dealing with, you heard of all the problems, but let's talk about the government for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
You've got all kinds of regulations. You have to have compliance officers to figure out what your duties are under different laws. Let's say, for example, diversity. And nowadays, you have to employ certain types of people in certain amounts and certain percentages. And if you don't, you're into problems of diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, talk about the environment. Now, these are all new things. You got oil and grease and garbage and tanks where you're cleaning meat, and you got drippings from the fat. You have lighting, you have flooring, you have the parking lots, you have the buildings, fumes, your trucks.
all kinds of stuff you got to account for.
Just on those two things, the environmental impact of what you're doing and diversity, those are a lot of employees and a lot of time. You have rules and regulations and forms to fill out that would drive you crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Day and night you have to fill out forms to the government, reports, all kinds of reports. Then you talk about employees and unions. Dealing with a union is not the president. Present President Biden tends to say, oh, that's a union job, and he's a very pro-union man, we'll create union jobs. That's wonderful, and that's good because it's a good living wage. They get a lot of money, and they can bargain with management rather than you as an individual can't do anything with management,
right.
But they as a group can. And so it's fair until they overreach, until they get corrupt, until they get Jimmy Hoffa or somebody like that. And they wind up getting involved with the mafia, hand in hand, and they'll put you out of business. So what about the trucking, the Teamsters? I used a different name in the story, but if you don't comply, you can have trouble, a lot of trouble. They have strikes, Then there's political pressure. You have to donate money to the political parties to keep them friendly to you.
Mm-hmm.
You have social pressure, very strong social pressure about what you're doing in society and how you're functioning. Are you doing something that's damaging young girls? Are they getting overly concerned about their weight because you're selling products that have fat in them or sugar in them?
Yeah.
And you're selling them. You have.
You haven't even gone into the financial part.
Yeah. Then you have internal theft. It's tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
People coming at night that work for you have the keys and come in and take stuff. Restaurants go broke because the chefs are taking the steaks out the back door.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's a lot of. It's not easy to run a business. They have a. They get in trouble for redlining. You know what redlining is?
Mm-mm.
If you don't, let's say you're an insurance company and you're going broke with all the claims for hurricanes in the Gulf states. So you say, we're not going to sell insurance in Louisiana. Well, you can't do that. If you're going to be a national company, you may have obligations.
Have
you can't redline it. You can't cut them out.
Ah.
Or redline out districts that have a minority people because they're economically not as strong or able to pay as other areas. That's called redlining. That's there are so many things you can't control. New inventions come in. I was talking to you about new inventions, things that go out, like the typewriter and smoking pipes and all kinds of the telegraph,
mm-hmm.
gets out. And now the home phones are going to go away. In the next generation, there'll be no telephones in the house. There'll be no landlines. It'll be gone.
Yeah, it's true.
The pay phones. You can see them. I can just think of 100 things that have come and gone. So there's obsolescence. Mm-hmm. And in business, that's a big problem. Okay, that gives you some idea of the difficulties in running a business. Then you talk about thieves. Well, you say maybe you can deal with thieves. Thieves deal with one another. Honor amongst thieves. Well, there's no such thing anymore. No. Used to be. But when you became vested in the mafia or invested, you took an oath and you cut your finger with blood oaths. Oh. And the oath is that you don't turn on your fellow members. You don't rat on anybody. You don't testify. Mm-hmm. Well, in 1971, as recently as 1971, because for me, I'm an old man, it's recent, they came up with the Witness Protection Program. Mm-hmm. And some very smart young attorney in the Justice Department, as I recall, came up with the concept that in order to get people to testify against one another, they would give them witness protection. They mm-hmm. would give them new lives. So they would relocate you with new identity. You would be protected by the United States Marshals. And you're given money, like $60,000, to relocate. They would find you new employment or help you. You would get a car or a used car.
Sounds like a great great bargain.
You would. It was very, very efficient to do that. And this is for life, mm-hmm. for your whole life. But you would have to cut off your life with your outside family.
Uh-huh.
So you might bring one or two members of your family with you if they wanted to go. It's like exile.
Yeah.
But you leave everything behind. And then they would give you options to have different sites where you could be relocated. And they would give you a monthly stipend, supposedly to be phased out. Now, they had to do your... they ran into a lot of problems initially because they didn't realize, and you talk about people who go missing or try to hide, they didn't realize the problems they were getting with documents, because we have this whole life of documents.
Yeah.
So some smart investigators would go back to the hospital where you were born. You had to have hospital records of where you were born in the hospital. Not just a birth certificate, and not just a social security card, and not just a driver's license, and not just a passport. You would have to go back to the records, your child's school records from elementary school with teachers' comments.
Oh, yeah.
They had to go back and create a whole record and insert it into these schools.
Just, not just yours, but then your family's too.
Right.
Yeah.
That's some job. So they had...
investment, too, from the government.
Yeah. Yeah. They did this for about 8,500 witnesses and about 9,900 family members. And then what happens if they go back to crime?
Oh.
Under the new name. Well, those are just some of the things that I thought would be of interest to you.
Yeah. And
I was talking about dealing with different governments and so on. It's easier for business to deal in a dictatorship than it is in a democracy, because of all these people. In a dictatorship, you call up the boss and you don't have to fill out forms. You don't have any protests. You don't have any unions.
It's true.
You cut that whole the dictator tells everybody what's going to be, who's going to get this. There's no competition. And he gets a kickback. His family or his designees get a kickback.
That's a good point.
Yeah, so the Russian governments, they don't have to worry about competition. What else? I was going to tell you some things about the government too, because it's hard to run a business. Crime pays.
Crime pays.
It does. You always hear crime doesn't pay. This is a story about crime and the mafia. Well, it pays.
Yeah.
It pays better than non-crimes.
A lot
of crime is not solved, and they get away with it. Did you know that?
Yeah.
You know the incidence of convictions or even arrests in crimes? Mm-hmm. Okay. How many unsolved murders do you think there are in the United States? Just out of murder.
Wow.
Unsolved murders.
Yeah, hundreds of thousands?
Right. 250,000 unsolved murders. Now, of the solved murders, most of them are family murders, where the wife shoots the husband because he's running around with another girl. The husband kills the wife because he wants to marry her girlfriend. The kids shoot the father. It's family.
Yeah.
Family stuff.
Yeah. Family ties, someone you know kind of thing.
Right. And it's all right. And someone you know.
Yeah.
It's the same way.
But when it's someone hired,
it's
by
very
some
hard.
Organization.
They don't solve them. Only, I think, about 46% of crimes, of violent crimes, show indictment or arrest. Even 18% of the property loss claims are recovered. A very, very low numbers.
Very low, yeah.
So crime does pay, and it's very, very tough. I was talking to you also about the different countries and the different governments, and our government is unusual. We're probably the only government in the world that thinks in terms of freedom as much as we do. Very few.
Hmm.
There are a few other countries that do that, but not that many.
Hmm.
And even then, our democracy is very strange. I was arguing in Moscow. I was involved in a debate with some Russians about our democracy, and they were very quick to point out that our government was created for men only, until the 19th Amendment came along in 1920,
yeah.
You know, women didn't have any say, and that, in fact, senators, if you look at the electoral votes, they are not based on the popular vote.
Right.
The Electoral College is based on a combination of the number of representatives you have in the House of Representatives, and you add the two senators.
Mm-hmm.
So you get like 55 in California as opposed to almost a similar amount, two senators from every state.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not democratic.
Yeah. Those are good points.
Yeah. And, 55% of Americans now want to divide the United States anyhow. So it's, we have all kinds of problems. But we do have some wonderful idealistic concepts that go back quite a ways. The concept of, democracy as opposed to dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
Or monarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to tell you a little bit about that, because that came up recently about the, you know anything about Article 2 in the 12th Amendment, about how you elect, how the electors function, the president is elected,
no.
And what happened on January 6th. Maybe I'll say that for another time, but it's a very complicated way of what happens and how the election is certified. And it's not just time piling up the numbers on a machine, and the machine comes out, and that's automatically the president. It's a very complicated, long, drawn-out thing.
Hmm.
And then I was going to talk to you about the four freedoms, but I don't know if you ever heard of that, the four freedoms.
No, what are they?
But these are interesting things. I'm going off on a tangent for a reason, because nobody knows about the four freedoms. And maybe I'd do a separate podcast on the four freedoms, but they were freedom, the ones that, freedom of worship, freedom of speech, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. And if you think about those things, we'll save that for another time. But that came from a speech, by the way. I think Franklin Delano Roosevelt made that speech in 1941, January 1941.
Oh.
And in January and in December 7th, 1941, we got into World War II.
Oh, yeah.
So that's related. That's a whole history thing that we'll save about the Four Freedoms, about Norman Rockwell's painting. But the bottom line is that it is more efficient to run a business if you're in the mafia with no government regulations, and it's more profitable. And that's what happened here. This business was going under, and the minute you took away all these problems with the rules and regulations, and they could bribe and steal, they could do anything, threaten. If some inspector came around and he didn't gave him a hard time, all he'd say is, look, you got a wife and kids, you want them alive, you leave me alone.
Yeah.
And boy, they left him alone. So it was the formula works, but it's not a good formula.
It's not. It's unfortunate that, it works better when there's some kind of crime involved. But wow. Thank you for that insight.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Don't forget to like our Facebook page, Miami Memoirs, and be sure to pick up a copy of Lewis Ress's new book on Amazon.